Welcome back to the third in our series of reverse autoimmune disease summits. This is the autoimmune brain. And I'm delighted to probably bring you somebody that needs no introduction, Dr. Peter Osborne. He has been on our summits before. He's the clinical director of Origins Healthcare in Sugarland, Texas. He's a doctor of chiropractic, doctor of pastoral science, and board certified clinical nutritionist. He's oftentimes referred to as the gluten-free warrior and is one of the most sought after alternative medicine doctors in the world. His practice is centered on helping those with painful, chronic, degenerative, and autoimmune diseases using natural methods. Dr. Osborne is one of the world's leading authorities on gluten sensitivity and lectures nationally on this and many other nutritionally related subjects. He's the author of the bestseller, No Grain, No Pain. Welcome to this series, Dr. Osborne.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, I would love to hear what comes up for you when you hear the term autoimmune brain.
Yeah, lots of things. I mean, autoimmune brain, you know, I wrote the book No Grain, No Pain, but I could also very easily say no grain, better brain, right? Yeah. So the brain itself, when we talk about grain, there's just so many different qualities around grain that can impact the brain in a negative way. And most people really fixate on gluten. Here's what we know about gluten specifically. Gluten is a protein found in grains that, if consumed by somebody who has a sensitivity, can create inflammation of the brain directly, meaning that there are antibodies that have been, you know, discovered that show that gluten can actually create an inflammatory immunological response, autoimmune response in a person's brain, hence the term brain inflammation. And so gluten can cause that, again, direct neurological damage. But on top of that, gluten has been shown, there's subfractions of the gluten protein. One of them is called gluteomorphin, which has been shown to interact with morphine receptors in the brain. And when it does this, it can actually create a very unique scenario. One of them is it masks its own toxicity. So think about that for a minute. Morphine's a drug people use to take when they're in pain. And so when the food itself creates pain from inflammation, right? No grain, no pain. The morphine-like effect of gluten has the ability to mask that pain or actually act as its own medication as it's creating inflammatory damage. So a lot of people, they'll say, hey, I've been eating gluten for a long time and I don't really feel that bad.
Or it doesn't bother me. That's always, right?
That's
gluten
right.
Doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother me. It just gives me a fix of morphine so that I don't
right.
feel bad.
In fact, I felt fantastic when I've been off it for a while and it gets back into my system, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, so on that note, some people actually develop gluten withdrawal syndrome.
Right.
Sometimes, meaning they go off of gluten and feel much worse because they're not getting their fix. So there's this gluteomorphin connection that again can cause a reduction in pain, but it can also cause brain fog, you know, just like morphine slows down your thought process. It's not speeding you up, right? It's slowing you down. It's a downer. So it can slow down your thinking. So your clarity, your focus, you know, brain fog is a common manifestation of gluten-induced interaction with the brain. But that's just gluten. So we've got gluten creating an autoimmune inflammatory process around the brain. We've got gluten masking its own toxicity, creating a morphine-like response, which can reduce a person's pain, but also slow down their brain. But then we also have other non-gluten entities of grain, which can cause problems in the brain. And one of the biggest is that grain, as a family of food, we'll just call it a family of food, is very, very high in carbohydrate. And so what it's going to do is it's going to spike blood sugar, which leads to a spike in insulin and subsequent spike in cortisol. And these hormones, what happens over time, you know, the more this happens, the more a person consumes grain consistently in their diet with high carbohydrate levels, is it actually tends to lead toward what's known as type 3 diabetes, otherwise known as Alzheimer's disease or dementia. So we get kind of there's a term in science called glycation. And that's where you eat too many carbohydrates. And so your blood becomes super thick and sticky, just as if you poured syrup on the floor. Imagine you're pouring syrup into your bloodstream. And that stickiness starts to coat or wrap around or surround your protein. So it can wrap around your hormones. You know, women, it can wrap around your estrogen. It can wrap around your progesterone. it wraps around. One of the ways we test this is we test a protein called hemoglobin A1C, where we're measuring the quantity of sugar that's wrapping around hemoglobin inside of red blood cells. But this glycation or this sugar wrapping process makes it harder for hormones to communicate. It makes it harder for the heart to pump blood to the brain, get the oxygen to the brain, right? So that increased blood sugar is virtually increasing the risk for a number of different diseases, but dementia is definitely one of them. I mean, newer research is showing that dementia is really, it's technically a form of diabetes. And some people, when they have diabetes, it's primarily, it's a systemic diabetes where they have high blood sugar and it causes them to gain weight or be obese. And it leads to contributing factors like elevations in blood pressure, et cetera. But some people, the blood sugar affects their brain more than it does their heart. For some people, a perfect example would be dementia. Another example of how blood sugar can affect somebody differently would be like PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, where a woman develops this problem. It's a form of diabetes of the ovaries, right? But they don't necessarily have diabetes, but they have this problem that manifests as a PCOS, which is high carbohydrate intake or high blood sugar. So blood sugar can affect different people in different ways. And the reason I even point those things out is because, just like you said it a minute ago, some people say, well, I eat gluten, it doesn't bother me. Well, some people say, well, I don't have dementia and I eat grain all the time, but they may have PCOS or they may have like general diabetes or some other form of blood sugar abnormality. Remember, we're all unique and different. And so when you consume grain, it comes with the package of increased carbohydrates. This is why the keto diet is so wildly popular right now. You also have to understand that your brain primarily uses ketones as an energy substrate or energy source. If you bog it down with carbohydrates, it won't work as well. It's not going to function as well. So brain fog, again, is a big symptom. Now, I'm going to go backward a little bit because I missed something that I wanted to say, and it just slipped my mind, and that is, back to gluten, there's a lot of research coming out that's showing that gluten causes schizophrenia, okay, which is a brain disorder, that it causes depression and bipolar disease. So maybe you don't have some of those other things, but maybe you've been diagnosed with bipolar, or maybe you've been struggling with depression. There's research now linking gluten to autoimmune responses in autistic kids and adults, autistic behavioral disorders. So I just wanted to backtrack on gluten for a minute because I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that gluten could also create or contribute to those particular conditions.
And gluten can also be a trigger that causes genetics that you have on board to express themselves in those ways. Rather than being a cause, it can be a trigger, right?
So, I mean, the way I look at gluten is there are different genes that I measure in my clinic that help me to understand whether or not a person's going to react to gluten. And so these diseases, or let me reframe that, these genes aren't diseases, right? A lot of times people get into that whole mindset, I have bad genes, right? It's not about bad genes, it's about your genes. And so there are certain markers, genetic markers, that if a person has them, then when they consume gluten, these genes will be activated. And the activation sequence of these genes is a couple of different types of inflammation. We can get either what's called a Th1 response, which is a one side of the immune system. T helper is what Th stands for, T helper cells. And then we can get a Th2 response. And so these responses are basically, imagine, Th1 and Th2, it's like a conglomeration of different types of chemicals that create inflammation, and a conglomeration of different kinds of antibodies that are trying to defend your body from the exposure to gluten. And so we know gluten can impact people in both those ways. And we know that people with the genetic susceptibility are those that tend to react to gluten more specifically. Because some people react to gluten, but some people react to grain because it's high carb. Some people react to grain because it's the way they grow grain today, it's full of glyphosate and other pesticides and chemicals. Some people react to grain because it can be contaminated with mold and they're highly sensitive to mold. And so we've got like mold and mycotoxins that can contaminate grain. So it's a little different for different people, which is why I like to isolate the genetics, because if you are truly gluten sensitive genetically, that's a lifelong deal. Like if you're not and you want to consume grain sometimes, it's not necessarily the end all be all. But if you're gluten sensitive, one breadcrumb or think of it as a drop of water mixed with a gallon of water, right? That's how small of an amount of gluten it takes to create an inflammatory response for as long as 2 months. So like if you're cheating on the weekend, right, you just mm-hmm. have a little gluten on the weekend, and you're just hammering yourself repetitively with enough gluten that it allows for continuous inflammation over time.
So the reason I brought this up is because I do genetic testing on 100% of my patients in my practice because of this very thing that you're talking about. And I'm not a huge fan of the artificial intelligence way that just takes out a few genes and snips and talks about them and says what supplements to take for them, you know, because really when I go through a genetic report with my clients, I'm saying, you know, if you'll do these things that I'm pointing to right now, then these others over here don't have to express, you know, this problem that you could have with estrogen, you know, and which can lead to some of the things that estrogen receptor positive cancers and things like that, or this series of genes that these SNPs that can lead to an expression in autoimmune disease. If you'll do these that your body's saying, I can't do, right? And listen to it, be in a collaborative relationship with it, then it doesn't need to express this stuff. And I think people don't really understand that, just as you were just saying, they think of it as sort of a disease orientation instead of everything's working together here. And if you'll cooperate with your body, if you'll collaborate with it and you listen to, you know, you don't buy a car and then get the instruction that it needs either electricity or this kind of fuel and then do something different to it. You know, you actually listen, you say, oh, okay. And I always think about genetics as that kind of owner's manual, right? This is what your body's saying. So then that means you're not going to on the weekend stick something different in your car than what the owner's manual tells you to do, right? It doesn't make any sense.
You would hope not. I mean, genes aren't disease. They're what you're born with. They're the gift that God gave you, right?
Right.
That's the way I look at it. They're not the curse. They're the gift.
Right.
What happens is what most people do with that gift is they throw it on the floor and stomp on it. And then they get frustrated when their bodies don't work right for them. And you have to understand that your genes plus your environment, which is your choices, the summation of your choices, they stimulate your genes to behave in a manner that's consistent with adaptation. So your genes aren't doing what they're not supposed to do. They're trying to keep you alive. If you have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, for example, and most of us do, and you sit on your keister all day and you eat sugar all day, then your genes will adapt by producing more insulin. And that insulin will help you deal with that sugar better. And over time, you'll become insulin resistant and you'll develop diabetes, and we'll call that disease. So the way I look at disease is it's really disease begins where adaptation ends. When your body can no longer adapt to your foul choices, then it tries to scream at you and yell at you by giving you symptoms that you need to pay attention to so that you can understand what changes you need to make in your diet and lifestyle.
And it's always started not in screaming. It's always started with this little tiny, small, quiet, little gentle touch, you know? And I can look backwards and realize, oh, that was where the quiet voice was that I didn't listen to, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was getting quiet notifications from my body all through my teens and 20s, and then running marathons and popping 800 milligrams of ibuprofen at mile 13, you know, and saying, gosh, why is everybody in pain? All you have to do is take ibuprofen. It takes it right away, you know, and my poor body, right? And I was sucking down those gels, which are full of gluten. And then it turns out genetically, I am incredibly genetic intolerant, you know, just a little freckle shy of celiac. So, you know, when I saw that, I realized, oh, you know, all of these so-called healthy things that I thought I was doing, that the culture supports, you know, marathon running, I thought was a healthy thing to engage in. And I did it for probably 15 years. Then, oh, you know, the way that I was doing it and how I was engaging with it, how I was fueling my body and taking care of it during my long workouts and training was not in accordance to what this body actually, its infrastructure, its blueprint was set up to be. So that's what I think the gift of really doing, I always say test, don't guess, you know, of really going in and asking your body with real compassionate curiosity, what is it that you need from me in order to function at your most optimal? you know, this beautiful gift that I've been given, and I get one. So why wouldn't I want to treat it with the most love and concern and care that I possibly can, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are some, we talked a little bit about some of the inflammatory brain inflammatory diseases that fall into the spectrum. The brain and the gut and your whole nervous system, there's so much evidence that show that they're related. And one of the things that people will kind of fall into in a limited view of those two things being related from a scientific standpoint, the one of the things that I notice is if I ask somebody, I go through their genetics with them, and then I say, if you know, you're a freckle shy of being celiac, or you're extremely gluten sensitive, or even a little bit mildly gluten sensitive, you know, you need to really, really make sure that you honor this instruction from your body. And then if I have a patient come back in who's going through a divorce, or has a special needs child, or who just lost their job, or, you know, et cetera, and their knuckles are swollen and their gut is inflamed. And I ask the question, so how have you been doing with your self-care and your diet? And they say, oh, well, that's all out the window because I'm so stressed out. You know, I see this all the time. I'm sure you do too. What do you say to folks who really at the time when their body needs them to care for it the most wind up turning towards foods that have gluten and sugar in them as a comfort mechanism?
Well, mostly I just let them stew in their own pain. I mean, the best lessons are the lessons learned through hard knocks, in my opinion, in my experience. I mean, if we didn't learn those lessons, then we would never really associate the deviation from the diet with the pain or the symptoms that we're experiencing. So when somebody comes into me after they've deviated and they look at me and say, all my problems are back, I just look at them and I let them have their own thought. And very quickly, you know, what happens in their own brain is they say to themselves, and oftentimes I'll hear this, I sound like a total idiot because I know what I just did wrong. Here I am in your office. So, you know, making and helping them recognize that, you know, when they deviate, to pay attention and to become more intuitive to how they feel. You mentioned, you know, the small little whispers that your body was telling you before it became a yell. The more we start to realize that our choices and our diets impact the way our nuances of our body might speak to us, the more we can recognize how those languages are coming in. So, you know, for example, for me, if I am traveling and I get gluten exposure, one of the things that happens is a visual migraine. Like I'll pick up on a visual migraine. It's not a debilitating migraine. That's another neurological disease, by the way, linked to gluten sensitivity, is migraine headaches and something called cerebellar ataxia, which makes you dizzy and you can't stand up straight. But I'll get a little visual migraine, which is kind of floaters in the eye. So part of my visual field will go bad. And I know something just happened. And so that over years of having that occur to me, one of the things that I said, enough is enough. I just don't want to have that happen to me when I'm traveling. I just started carrying a food suitcase, right? So again, it's knowing your tells. What are your tells? For me, a little mild visual migraine, it doesn't really hurt, but it sure does bother my visual field is a problem for me. The other is that it makes me angry. Like when I get gluten, it makes me, you know, makes me emotionally more quick to temper. And so I treat other people probably with less respect than they deserve if I've been gluten, not on purpose, just because I'm just more irritable. So those are some of my tells. Some of my patients, I've got tells all over the place. Some of them get major migraines. Some of them get diarrhea. Some of them get bloody noses, just spontaneous nose bleeding. Some of them get little joint aches or joint pains. So those tells are different for different people. And once you've kind of learned to really pay close attention to them, you can really let those things help guide your decision-making, because everybody's going to deviate. I don't know a single person that's ever come to see me that didn't cheat, didn't deviate. And you know, the best thing you can do is don't beat yourself up over the deviation, forgive yourself and move on, but also don't use the deviation as an excuse to do more deviation. So like,
go
don't
down
say,
and flame.
I've already got a headache. I might as well just eat a whole cake now.
Right.
Because then you're going to pay a major price. It's not worth it. Just learn from the mistake, move on, and then do your best to make no purposeful mistakes, right? Accidents, forgive yourself for, but it's the purposeful mistakes. Those are the ones we know that we shouldn't do. And so become more aware and cognizant of how those things impact your health and how they impact the people around you that you care about and how you want to set the example as an individual to the people around you. Because that's the other kind of psychological thing that comes along with the diet change like this is, first of all, it's very socially challenging. And so if you deviate with your friends, if you deviate, you know, in front of a family member, what they're going to do is next time they're going to expect you to deviate again, right? And then you're going to get more and more and more pressure psychologically. So you've got to be strong in that way. And you've got to lead by example. You have to be the shining beacon of health that you want to represent so that they are also going to make good decisions. If they see you making bad decisions knowingly on purpose, then they're going to lose respect for you and your diet and why you're on that diet. So if you want to help yourself, one of the best ways that you can do that is see the world for how they will react to you if you blatantly disregard what you should be doing with your diet.
One of the things that really helped me, I call my process when I was first diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis when I was 30, this process of the detox retox roller coaster. And I would get cleaned up and I would feel good. And then I would start playing with my boundaries to see where, you know, where they were, which is what toddlers do. That's exactly what they do. You know, they want to challenge it and see if you're there to tell them that, nope, that's not okay. And so you can kind of figure that your toddler or adolescent developmental space has shown up when you say, I can't have. When I can't have, right? And so there was a time when finally it clicked in for me where I said, oh, this is rat poison. And there's never a time when I'm going to want to just play with rat poison. And so it's like really, really locking it into this understanding of exactly what it is to your body. Then it doesn't feel tempting anymore. You know, like I also carry a food suitcase. Even when I take groups to Peru and go on the Inca Trail, I've got my own food in a backpack. Like I carry all my food when I go to Africa, when I go anywhere, I have my own food. And then if there is food around that, that looks like my body will like it, then I will have it. And then if it doesn't, I don't have to say anything. I don't have to make a big deal. I don't have to, there's no issue. I have my own food, no big deal. So I never get into something now anytime when I have to eat something that's going to react, you know, activate my body in a way that is toward illness. So that's been an interesting journey, but you can arrive in that space. And I know you do too, Peter. Like you just like, no, that's not even a temptation, right?
Yeah. I mean, you lose a temptation after, you know, after you have beat yourself up a few times and
yeah.
And for some, they have to beat themselves up a little bit more than others. That's all.
Yeah. I was probably one of those. I always say I'm the worst patient I've ever had. The hardest nut to crack that God had to crack.
Doctors make terrible patients. So
what's that?
Doctors make terrible patients.
They really do. So the idea then that you're in a lifestyle rather than a diet, I think is also important, right? So that you're not activating your inner toddler or your inner adolescence, because adolescents don't make good choices traditionally, consistently, right? So you want to allow that part of you to just be okay and let your adult self, that's your wiser, older mind, then not reach for things like this as a form of comfort. I think that's what happens is people get driven into when they're in a time of crisis, they're triggered into a child state. And so they reach for what a child would reach for.
Yeah, or they just grew up and they socially celebrated with food so much that, you know, the connotation of food equals love is playing a backbone in that. And the food that they loved or that their parents expressed love with, you know, around the holiday times, what are they? They're birthday cakes, right? Halloween candy, they're Christmas cookies, you know? And so you default back into that celebratory, this is love. This is love. And I need love and I need emotional support when I'm stressed out. And so you just got to, what I encourage anyone to do is recognize, first of all, recognize that that's what's probably happening. And two is to create new love. You can still love with food. You can love with real food. And so, you know, instead of loving with, you know, with cookies that have hydrogenated fat and wheat gluten in them, you know, it's pretty easy to make some cookies that are grain free that don't have genetically modified ingredients or don't have pesticides, and that you can still use those as a tool, right? As a crutch, if you will, because they're not good for you all the time either, right? Recognizing that treats are very much that, right? They should not, this treats doesn't mean staple food. And so, but at the same time, I think socially, I think people, part of their life and culture is food. And so if you take that away and it's just all stoicism, then there's a depression that can set in, and that's a psychological brain problem too, right? So there's a depression that come in, and they'll go through mourning, right? I mean, a lot of, you probably see this, but a lot of people learning that they need to be gluten-free, they'll mourn it first. So they'll go through the phases of grief, you know, the denial, the anger, the bargaining, the depression, before they come along to the acceptance stage. And sometimes they'll go back and forth in that first four stages before they come around to acceptance. And that's just everybody's journey. There is a little bit different. And so I've just learned that, you know, in that regard, let them make their mistakes and recognize them, and realize that they are mistakes, and that they can't have that old default methodology, and then come around to that acceptance point where then we can really strategize on health optimization versus just trying to get your diet right.
Well, and that's why, you know, the cookbook that I wrote for people with autoimmune disease, it's like ingredients that are 7 ingredients or less, all the recipes, and it's done in a template format so that you learn how to put something together with things that your body will like, and you can actually trade out things, and it shows you how to do that. It shows you the chemistry of cooking, basically, and how to do that in a way that for you, because there's just no one autoimmune paleo plan. That just isn't true, right? So it's like, how is it there are these things that are going to cause inflammation, like gluten and, you know, grains, and for most people, I don't know how you feel about this, but I'm really not a fan of dairy either, and I'm definitely not a fan of sugar. So, you know, it's like, how to do, I make the most amazing birthday cakes, you know, and our family have 4 children, and over the last 20 years I have some remarkable chefs in my kids. They have this sense of adventure in the kitchen, and they create, you know, anti-inflammatory dinners. And it's amazing how good it tastes, right? We've all played with this for so long with the sense of adventure rather than a sense of deprivation. Like, okay, how can we come together as a family in the kitchen, play music, dance, laugh? You know, it doesn't have to be around the things that we used to eat when they were small children. So I think it depends on how you're approaching it. You can take this with a sense of adventure rather than a sense of deprivation.
Well, deprivation of food, or deprivation of how well you feel. You have a choice.
Yeah.
I choose to see the food as not a deprivation, but as a adventure. And what we're actually depriving ourselves of is a miserable life full of disease and autoimmunity.
Right. Yeah. Right. So when you think about autoimmune brain, what is something that we might have left out in that discussion?
Several diseases. So, you know, autoimmune brain, multiple sclerosis, which is brain, but also, spinal cord.
Nervous system. Yeah.
Creates the muscle weakness. It creates the degenerative changes down the spinal cord that lead to the inability for a person to function. And so there's multiple sclerosis. There's also Parkinson's disease, or which is another form of neurologically induced condition as a result of the wrong food. In most cases, I see related to that. Other things too, but gluten's a big one. There's cerebellar ataxia, which is a form of dizziness or imbalance when it's a part of the brain that gets impacted with gluten, and a lot of research on that, probably more research on that neurologically than any other form of neurological disease that gluten can cause. It's called cerebellar ataxia. And then we have gluten-induced migraine headaches. Migraines are a major problem. A lot of people taking migraine medications don't realize that gluten is one of the biggest triggers for migraine headaches that there is. Beyond those things, we've got neuropathy, common, which again, is not necessarily brain. The brain is a big nerve. It's a big cluster of nerves, but neuropathy itself, neuropathy of the brain, but you also have peripheral neuropathy. So numbness, tingling, weakness in the hands, burning neuropathies, severe pain, ascending neuropathies, you know, so pain that radiates from the feet and goes up and travels up and can take away your ability to walk. These are all neurological manifestations, or can be, of gluten sensitivity. And so understanding that if you're struggling with any of these neurological types of symptoms and your doctor hasn't ruled out gluten, right, as a potentiating factor, that would be something that would probably be worthwhile doing. Because what I see with most people chronically is they, when they come, by the time they come to me, you know, usually with neurological disease, they're either on an antidepressant, something like, you know, an SSRI, right, class of medication, or they're on a pain medication for their neuropathy. And that, you know, that could range from, you know, narcotics to something like gabapentin. Or they're on some type of neurological enhancing drug, you know, like they have ADD or they have attention deficit or they can't focus or concentrate. So they're taking something like Concerta or Ritalin, which is basically, in my opinion, legalized cocaine. You know, the doctors will tell you, you have your problem exists, but we don't really know what causes it, but we do know how to treat it. And here's this drug that you need to take for the rest of your life. And that, to me, never made any sense. It never made sense to me that that was the solution. Not when we have, especially in this case, an example of one particular type of food creating so much havoc on the nervous system that it's a simple test. I mean, literally it's a cheek swab. It's so simple to do. And it might give you some really, really major insight as to whether or not just a diet change could have major, major life-altering, life-saving effects for you just by changing your diet.
So important. And, you know, the thing about what you've just said is they're also from that place where we just talked about the disease process itself, but your brain can also be carrying around autoantibodies for years and years and years that you don't even know about. That's another thing we usually will test for. And, you know, when you do that test and you find, oh, I've got these autoimmune antibodies in my brain, then what do I do about that? And it really is about not triggering them into activity, right? Or taking them down so that they aren't active. It's the same, like, when we think about Epstein-Barr, you know, the CDC says 95% of Americans has Epstein-Barr virus. So, you know, is that the cause of everybody's trouble, as some people will say, you know? And I don't know what you think, but I always think, no, why don't we just make the body an inhospitable terrain for the virus so that it can be in remission and not actively causing havoc, right?
Yeah, I mean, I look at autoimmune disease really as simply as I think you can, which is it has triggers, right? There's certain things that will trigger it. And if you alleviate the triggers, then you pretty much can control the illness. And the triggers, you know, can be measured, right? Food is a trigger, not just gluten, but lots of food. You mentioned dairy. Dairy's a big one. My experience, sugar's a big one. But others can be too. I've seen people terminal over blueberries. I've seen people.
Me too.
Yeah, allergic to broccoli and cauliflower and superfoods. So it's different. Right. Right? But yeah. Chemical exposure, chemicals, another one. So pesticides, herbicides, food dyes, preservatives, things in cosmetics, things that are used as odorant agents in your cleaning products. Like these, all these different types of chemicals that we're being exposed to. There's about 30,000 new chemicals in the U.S. that we're exposed to on an annual basis that didn't exist 40 years ago. Those can be triggers as well. So I like to look at those triggers and try to minimize where people might be getting exposure to massive quantities of chemicals. The third trigger is microbial imbalance. Some people say infection, and I'm glad you mentioned Epstein-Barr a minute ago, because I agree with you. It's not necessarily the presence of the virus itself, because you could test everybody for Epstein-Barr and the vast majority of us are going to have titers to Epstein-Barr. It's not necessarily the actual virus itself per se, or the bacteria. I could swab everyone's cheek who's listening to this, and we're going to probably find E. coli and staph and strep. It's not an issue of whether it's present. It's an issue of whether it's present in such a quantity that it can take advantage of your system because your system's been weakened by your choices, right? So microbial imbalance is thing, instead of thinking it like infection, just think of it as your body is not resilient to the microbes around you. And so they tend to lead toward imbalances that can contribute to the triggering of autoimmunity. Then the fourth is nutritional deficit. which if your body's not getting adequate nutrients, vitamins, minerals from the food that you eat, then it will fundamentally begin to break down. There are certain nutrients we know can cause autoimmune disease when they're low. And vitamin D, for example, is one of them. Zinc is another. So, you know, there are 40 different essential nutrients that, in my opinion, should be measured when we're trying to isolate and identify what a person's nutritional status looks like. And then the fifth category is stress. And that's, you know, that stress can be physical, chemical, or emotional. Some people have emotional stress or traumatic stress, but some people have victimhood stress and they need to just be told some harsh truths and they need to be counseled a little bit. And some people have, you know, emotional stress or bad relationship stress, or they hate their job stress, like whatever it is. And it's not to say that we should all be in a bubble and never have stress. That's not what I mean. But when you couple overwhelming stress with poor diet, bad nutrition, you know, foods that you're reactive to, and you couple all those things with together, then what ends up happening is your body takes on more than what it's capable of handling, right? So you lose your ability to adapt. And in my opinion, loss of adaptation is what we call disease. So by the time your doctor gets around to calling it diabetes, your body's been trying to adapt to your bad choices for 20 years. And it's not until your body finally hits its breaking point, right? That loss of adaptability, that we actually can confirm that it's a disease state using lab tests, right? That in my opinion, many of the lab tests that doctors use only measure late stage disease. They don't really tell you much about how to deal with your life and your nutrition on an early level so that you don't end up with late stage disease. So again, I look at autoimmune triggers, those five families of triggers. And if we understand what they are and we can teach a person kind of how to navigate their own personal triggers, then we can pass the buck on. As doctors, it's not our responsibility to make you better. It's our responsibility to educate you on what your body needs in order to not generate sickness as a standard process of our function of old age, right? And so
on that, everybody.
Now you own yourself, right? So you own it.
Right.
You don't own it. You own it. But sometimes it's hard because you've been told you've got bad genes and you're just getting older and you're owning that. Like you're owning a different message because that's the message that your highly qualified doctor gave you, that expert that you went to at Cleveland or Mayo who says, you're getting older and you have bad genes. You own that because you respected that person's opinion, right? Because they went to medical school or wherever they went to school to get their degree. But you know, what they failed to teach you is that chronic degenerative inflammatory autoimmune disease is caused by lifestyle. It's not caused by bad genes, and it's certainly not caused by age. What's caused by is your choices multiplied over time, leading to your body's inability to continue to adapt. So it starts to scream at you in an effort to get you to listen. And if you can learn and understand that concept, then you can work with somebody who can help you isolate and identify what your unique triggers are. Because I've seen thousands of cases of autoimmune disease go into remission, but I've never seen a case of autoimmune disease be identical to another. So, you know, I can take 100 women with Hashimoto's and they all have it for, you know, maybe similar reasons, but their reasons are very unique to them. Some of them are gluten sensitive. Some of them are allergic to, you know, to beef. Some of them are reacting to strawberries. Some of them have a candida or a yeast overgrowth. Some of them have mercury, right? I mean, it just, you know, right. Those five families of triggers. And so those triggers, how many different possible triggers could we have? There's thousands. So which of them are yours? And if you understand what that is, then you can begin the process of healing and taking self-ownership and self-responsibility, which is, in my opinion, what this world is vastly lacking, not just in medicine, but in many walks of life is, you know, it's your body. You're the owner. You weren't born with a manual, but you can learn what your manual is if you quit ignoring good common sense and quit giving your power, right, to someone else to make the decisions for you. And that's where we're at. And that's why medicine, in my opinion, today in our world, medicine has failed to really create an environment of good health. It's become pseudo-compassionate pharmaceutical manipulation. So, I mean, doctors strive to be compassionate by giving you a drug that manipulates chemically the symptoms that you're experiencing without asking the question why you're experiencing the symptoms. That is pseudo-compassion, not true compassion. True compassion and forward progress begins with brutal truth. And sometimes that's the hardest message to hear, And sometimes people are ready for it and sometimes they're not. And you just have to ask yourself, are you ready for truth? And if you are, then you got to step up into the mirror, and you've got to be honest with yourself first so that you can begin your forward journey to good health.
Hey, that's a great place to end. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know you have a free gift for our audience.
Yeah, I've got something called the Autoimmune Matrix. It's a pretty extensive manual on a lot of what I've just talked about. It's these triggers and how you can go about looking for these triggers, and how to talk to your doctor about having the conversation about, hey, can you measure these things for me so that we can begin the process of healing? So I've got that as a free gift to anyone listening who just is ready to tell themselves the truth and take that journey.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Osborne. I appreciate you taking the time and your wisdom to share with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for doing this. I always know that anytime a doc puts something together like this, they're taking a risk. And so this is, you know, thanks and kudos to you for being brave to challenge the status quo.
Yes, thank you. Okay, everybody, until next time, be well.